Well, thank you, Richard. You can see I have to play a guitar in the evening or something. But just up here for tonight, this morning, this lunchtime, I'm completely out of sync. I wonder if you just take those Luke's Gospels that you've got in front of you, and if you'll turn to page 70, you'll see the story we're going to focus on this lunchtime. It's the story of a man called Zacchaeus. One of my favourite incidents about it concerns a famous Baptist preacher called Charles Spurgeon, who used to train preachers. And one of the little ordeals he used to put them through was this. He'd have them all in a class like this, and he'd simply say, pick on one of them to come and preach a sermon. And, you know, he'd see Mervyn there, and he'd just say, Mervyn, your turn next. And Mervyn would have to come out here, and at the bottom of there was a great high pulpit in his church, and at the bottom of the pulpit there'd be a little plate, and there'd be some slips of paper, and he'd pick out a slip of paper, and on it would be written the subject of the sermon he'd got to preach on. And once there was a very little guy who came along, and he picked up his piece of paper, and he climbed up this very tall pulpit, and he got there, and he turned over his piece of paper, and it had just got written on it, Zacchaeus. So he was nervous as anything, he didn't have a clue what to say, and he looked down at everyone, and he said, I've been asked to speak on Zacchaeus. He said, I only know three things about Zacchaeus. He was a very little man, and so am I. He found himself up a tree, and he looked down from the great height, and he said, and so do I. And he made haste to come down, and so will I. I've got to say a bit more today. I want us to look at the story, because it isn't just a lovely Sunday school story, where I imagine if any of us went to Sunday school, we remember it from. Luke doesn't include it because he's looking ahead to the day of Sunday schools. He's written it in his gospel because it is a great illustration of a man coming to faith, of a man being converted, of a man starting out with Christ. And because it's such a good illustration of that, it's the one I want us to have in the background as we consider this question that people often raise about faith. Is it all in the mind? And I want us to look at one or two of the common things people say and then compare it with the story we've got here. Faith, all in the mind. Firstly, is it all preconditioned? You'll see I put that down on these blue notes. Someone put it this way, Christian experience is a result of the way we've been conditioned by our upbringing to think and live. Now, if it's true, it makes us Christians sound a little bit like Pavlov's dogs, doesn't it? But is it true? I sometimes, when I hear that, want to say to the person, are they sure they haven't been preconditioned to say that everything's a matter of preconditioning? But more seriously, that kind of comment oversimplifies the situation. See, if you've any experience, either by travelling across the world or by sitting in somewhere like London and letting the world come to you, if you have any experience of the breadth of those who call themselves Christians, you'll realise they come from every conceivable background. I mean, even in my short life, I've met Christians from humanist backgrounds, Hindu backgrounds, Muslim backgrounds, atheist backgrounds, Marxist backgrounds. I've met black, brown, white and yellow Christians. I met them rich, I met them poor. I met them from public school and university, and I met them, well, they claimed they left school at 16, but some of them hardly went to it before. I met people who were the pillars of society, and others who are crooks and criminals, and now Christians. And each one of them will want to testify that a personal encounter with Jesus is what transformed their life. See, if a psychologist is doing his work in this kind of an area, he wants to keep all but one or two factors constant. And it's my experience, and not just mine, it's the experience of many Christians, that when you consider the evidence and the whole variety of backgrounds Christians come from, it's only Jesus that is the common factor. Now take a look at Zacchaeus. You see, he could hardly be less preconditioned. Look at the beginning of the story, at the beginning of chapter 19, verse 1. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through, and a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. That's all the introduction that Luke gives us to him, and yet it's in a sense all we need. It tells us that here was an immoral man. Oh, he might just have wanted to talk about his business practices as being sharp practice, but actually the truth was the man was a crook. And everyone knew it, including him. More than that, it means here is an irreligious man. He wouldn't have gone near the church of his day, the temple of his day. He wouldn't actually have been allowed to. Now, he's not the equivalent of the mafia boss who attends mass to look respectable, or the white-collar criminal going to his local parish church to pose as one of the establishment. Zacchaeus was out. It would have been made very clear to him that the temple wasn't his scene. He and God did not mix. That was his precondition. And you get the clear implication of it if you look down to verse 7. Because you see, when Jesus, when the one from God comes and invites himself to tea, as the Sunday school story puts it, what is the reaction of those around? Why, it's distaste, it's disgust. All the people saw this, and they began to mutter, they began to complain, they began to murmur. Now, their complaints in this case are directed against Jesus, but it's for this simple reason that everyone knew people like Zacchaeus and God did not mix. They said of Jesus, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. What is a holy one? Let alone the Holy One from God, if that's who he claims to be, mixing with him for. Faith, all a matter of preconditioning? No, let's dispose with that idea. It doesn't fit the evidence. It's not what's going on here. This isn't one of these gentle stories of a man who's slowly been brought up through all the right conventional things and finally is clinching the deal. Well, let's take another tack. Secondly, is it something that's just all in the mind? All wish fulfillment. You see, this is the person who says, well, religious experience can be traced to man's feeling a need for God, and then creating an image in his mind, and then worshipping that mental projection. See, it's all subjective reality, not objective reality. In that sense, it's something of a crutch for people who can't get along. And yes, you can understand why people might want to talk about wish fulfillment, can't you? The thought of actually knowing you're accepted and you're of worth and importance, that you've discovered a purpose for life. You can have a clear conscience and know that. That you know that death is not the end and there's something quite wonderful beyond it. Oh yes, who wouldn't want to believe that? Of course, it's wish fulfillment. Or is dismissing it like that simply looking a gift horse in the mouth? See, again, if I want to be flippant, I could equally well say that the person who doesn't believe in the Christian God is indulging in wish fulfillment. I can't honestly say that most non-Christians I've met are bravely facing reality. I could just as easily say they were fulfilling their wish to be free to indulge themselves, to run their life their way. It cuts both ways, doesn't it, this wish fulfillment game? But let's look at the story of Zacchaeus and we'll see something that's much more significant if we want to face this question. See verse 3, he wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man he couldn't because of the crowd, so he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. Ah yes, here's the man, he's terribly excited to know about Jesus, he'll go to any lengths to do it. This is just the seedbed for wish fulfillment, isn't it? Except for the fact that from that moment on in the story, all the significance revolves not around Zacchaeus, but around Jesus. See verse 5. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. It's Jesus who decides when to stop. It's Jesus who decides who he'll look at. It's Jesus who decides who he'll invite himself to. It's all something taking place outside of Zacchaeus' mind, isn't it? When Jesus comes to explain the significance of the story at the end, in verses 9 and 10, it's not explained in terms of Zacchaeus' thinking. Today, he says, salvation has come to this house because this man too is a son of Abraham, is truly one of God's people. Why? Because of what he thought? No. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save what was lost. See, salvation is explained in terms of what Jesus has done for someone. What this story illustrates, what the whole New Testament account tells us, what New Testament history is constantly pointing to, is the truth, the objective truth, that God's revealed himself in history through the person of Jesus, his life, his claims, his death, his resurrection. Understand this, that when I'm saying, oh, it's all in the mind for someone, it's just something that's nice for you, I'm not just saying something about Christians. I'm actually denying the objective reality about Jesus. Before I make those kind of statements, I'd better make sure I've done my research. And I've got the grounds for saying it. If I've not done that, then it might be worth just looking at the bookstall. There are one or two books there that actually deal with some of the objective evidence for this Jesus, because notice it in this story, it revolves around a Jesus from outside coming to the man, a Jesus calling him, a Jesus bringing salvation. Paul Little was a fine Christian apologist until his death a few years back, tragically. And he once found himself giving a series of lectures in a university, and there was a professor in the audience who was a thoroughgoing relativist. And he kept standing up in the middle of the lectures and interrupting them and gently debunking everything Little had been saying. And his thesis went something like this, that what's true for us isn't necessarily true for other people. And one of his big ways of illustrating it was to take an example of a student rag week where a student's kidnapped and tied to a railway line. And the express comes roaring by on the next door line, and the student has a heart attack and dies. He does so because he thought the express was on his line. It wasn't, but it might just as well have been. And the professor was wanting to say, see, isn't Christianity a little bit like that? All in the mind. And Little and his friends kept trying to say to him, look, the difference between your little story and Christianity is the resurrection. An event in history that actually happened. Something of objective reality. Well, the professor never saw it, and he just kept on springing to his feet and interrupting again. And Little said, about the fourth time round, the penny dropped. And the professor was at the blackboard doing his doodles, explaining his theory, when suddenly it dawned on him what was being said, and he said, oh yes. Yes, I suppose that would make a difference, wouldn't it? And Little says, from that moment on, he sat down and shut up. You see, what I'm really wanting to say to people is, if you want to say it's all in the mind, will you stop patronizing us? Will you please not come out with the line that, look, it's all right for you, and if it helps you, I'm very pleased for you. Because that's not what I'm saying. I'm actually saying this thing is truth. Jesus is coming and saying what's happened to Zacchaeus is reality. Now, either he's got it all wrong and we must dismiss Jesus, or we can't have little games about it being fine for one and not for the other. You see, as this man comes to faith, and as Luke tells this story to show it to us, it is something from outside of him. someone from outside of him who is coming to make the difference. Preconditioning? No. That won't explain Christians. All in the mind? Well, if it is, then the whole Christian story goes up in smoke. Have you researched the evidence enough to be able to say that? A change of mind? Ah, yes, that's true. That's certainly true, isn't it? Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not trying to suggest that nothing happened in Zacchaeus' mind. Well, the most amazing things went on in Zacchaeus' mind that day. And they clearly started in his mind. He changed his mind radically that day. He changed his mind so much that he acted completely differently from how he began the day. And indeed, that's what faith is all about. Faith is the kind of change of mind that means you've got a change of action. Well, I've just jotted down on this sheet of paper three ways in which he changed his mind. He changed his Lord. He started the day his own boss, didn't he? There wouldn't have been a Jew in the country he would have owned as Lord. And there wouldn't have been a Jew in the country who would have wanted him as a servant. But he ends it, you'll see in verse 8, by calling Jesus Lord. He ends it by identifying with Jesus. He's the servant. Jesus is the Lord. Yes, faith is a change of allegiance. And with it come a whole host of other things. He changes security. He starts the day a wealthy man. He ends it very much poorer. Radically poorer. Don't think that it would have been an easy thing for Zacchaeus to have given away his money. I mean, imagine the man. He was something of an outcast in society. No one would have given him any grace or favor. Tell me, what was the one thing he'd got going for him? Oh, Luke's already told us right at the beginning, hasn't he, in verse 2. He was the chief tax collector and he was wealthy. That was his one security. No doubt he got a lovely pad in the gin and jag belt and out there it could have been lovely for him. But that's all he's got. Now, tell me what makes a man give away the only thing he's got. Because that's what he's doing when you discover in verse 8, he's giving his possessions to the poor. Yes, he's changed his security. He's abandoning the only thing that gave him any worth, status, security in life up to that moment. And of course, Luke illustrates it in terms of riches, because obviously Zacchaeus was a rich man, but also it fits one of the themes that goes through his gospel, that it's our very riches that often hide us from being the one person that Jesus can save, because you'll notice Jesus only comes to seek and to save those who are lost. Now, your riches may be your money, they may be your brains, your power, your success, your reputation, your standing, it doesn't matter what. It's sometimes all sorts of little things that we hang on to stop us admitting we're lost. It's always stuck in my mind that when the Marcuses were kicked out of their palace in Philippines, I don't know if you remember this, and they ransacked the palace, they discovered in Mrs. Marcus's wardrobe 2,700 pairs of shoes. You imagine it, ladies? What have you always imagined, that you could have 5,400 shoes? You know, some American journalist who had nothing better to do worked out that if she changed her shoes three times a day, it would take her 2.5 years to get through them all. That's assuming she hadn't bought any more. Some ridiculous things we hang on to security, but we'll hang on to them very tightly, won't we? I mean, imagine in a country like that where the contrast between rich and poor was so clear, she'll hang on to those shoes. And Zacchaeus is giving them up. He swapped one security, the security that his wealth gave him, for another security, a security that is utterly dependent on this Jesus. Because you see, as he's up the tree, Jesus comes to him, doesn't he? And he says to him, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm a stay at your house today. And he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. He swaps the security of his wealth for the security that Jesus can give him. And what is that security? It's this astonishing mixture. Jesus becomes the first person who will see Zacchaeus for who he is and accept him. This mixture of truth and acceptance, reality and acceptance. It's easy to get one side or other of those, but you get the two. See, Zacchaeus could accept himself, no doubt, but only at the expense of not facing up to the truth about himself. The 101 reasons why he had to do the tax collecting job. And we've all got them. We've all heard them, haven't we? Well, someone's got to do it. You know, if it's not me, it'll be someone worse. And you excused yourself with the business practices that way or heard others do it? I mean, it's just what everyone does in the tax collecting business. Oh, the crowd could tell him the truth about himself. Not just that he did those things, but that they were wrong. Just they could never accept him. See, Jesus comes along and he stops under that tree and he says, Zacchaeus. And the moment he names him, he makes it quite clear he knows who he's talking to. Now, it wasn't that Jesus got the wrong person. Thought he'd got some innocent and actually lands up with a crook. No, Zacchaeus, I know you. I know you for who you are and what you are. And then he says, come down. I'm a stay at your house. I accept you. Yeah, that's what makes Christians invulnerable. You can prick the balloon of almost any other security, can't you? That man who's got himself $3.5 million on the futures market or whatever it is he's just done recently, I saw in the papers, you know, and he's reinvesting it all. That can be pricked any time. If the index goes down, he's had it. But only when we've really faced up to the truth about ourselves and we know ourselves for the rotten people we are and everything else, and we've still found an acceptance with the reality about ourselves, we're invulnerable. It's a change of security. And it was a change of action. I want you to see that verse 6 and verse 8 are inextricably linked. He couldn't identify with Jesus and not land up giving half of his possessions to the poor. See, that's what it involved. Once he's come alongside Jesus, he's going to live the Jesus way. And so he says, look, I'm giving half of them to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I'll pay back four times the amount. And don't worry, that word if is the least, you needn't put any emphasis on it. There's no doubt about the if. It wasn't as if it was a remote possibility. The bookies wouldn't have taken any bets. Yes, faith is a change of life. Sometimes it's very painful. In Belfast in the last century, when there was a revival and many of the shipyard workers turned to Christ, they began returning all the bits and pieces they'd whipped from the shipyard and taken home with them. They had to build an extra warehouse to store them. Now, for you, the change of life might be nothing so dramatic. It can still be very costly. That's why question two is there. Well, your discussion over coffee. Thanks for listening.